James Joyce's semi-autobiographical masterpiece, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, stands as one of the most influential coming-of-age novels in literary history. Published in 1916 after appearing serially in The Egoist, this groundbreaking work revolutionized narrative technique with its stream-of-consciousness style that evolves alongside its protagonist. The novel has influenced countless writers, from Virginia Woolf to Salman Rushdie, and remains a cornerstone text in modernist literature. Famously, Ernest Hemingway declared it showed him that writing could be done in a new way. Beyond literary circles, the book resonates deeply with anyone who has struggled with identity, religion, nationality, or artistic purpose. Its exploration of an individual breaking free from societal constraints continues to speak to readers seeking their authentic voice in conformist environments. Stephen Dedalus's story begins in early childhood with the tender fairy tale of Baby Tuco told by his father. These initial memories establish the novel's technique of revealing consciousness through evolving language. As a small boy at Clongowes Wood College, Stephen contemplates his place in the vast universe, writing in his geography book, Stephen Dedalus, Class of Elements, Clongowes Wood College, Salins, County Kildare, Ireland, Europe, the World, the Universe. This expanding awareness culminates in his first philosophical question, what lies beyond the universe? To which he can only answer, God. The young Stephen's religious education shapes his perception of the world. At night in the cold chapel, he trembles while saying prayers, fearful that if the gas goes down before he finishes, he'll be condemned to hell. This early introduction to Catholic guilt and fear becomes a defining force in his development. Even in these early scenes, we see the seeds of the conflict that will drive the narrative, Stephen's simultaneous attraction to and rebellion against religious authority. Political tensions intrude on Stephen's childhood innocence when he witnesses heated arguments between Dante and his father over Parnell, Ireland's fallen political hero. This division foreshadows the larger conflicts between nationalism and individualism that Stephen will later face. When he falls ill at school, his feverish imagination turns to thoughts of death and burial, finding strange beauty and melancholy. This early aesthetic response to mortality hints at his future artistic sensibility. The Christmas dinner scene brilliantly captures how adult conflicts shape a child's understanding. What begins as a festive occasion deteriorates into bitter political argument when conversation turns to priests meddling in politics. The explosive confrontation, with Dante defending the clergy who condemned Parnell while Mr. Dedalus and Mr. Casey attack them, introduces Stephen to the painful divisions in Irish society. When Mr. Casey breaks down sobbing for poor Parnell, the scene etches itself into Stephen's consciousness, showing how personal and political are inseparably intertwined in Irish life. At Clongowes Wood College, Stephen first encounters the complex social dynamics of adolescence through whispered conversations among his peers. These early experiences, combined with innocent memories like Eileen Vance's gentle gestures, become connected in his mind with religious imagery, particularly the Tower of Ivory, a reference to the Virgin Mary. This demonstrates how his developing self-awareness becomes deeply intertwined with his Catholic upbringing, setting the stage for future internal conflicts. A defining moment occurs when Father Dolan punishes Stephen for perceived laziness despite his broken glasses making work impossible. The physical discipline becomes more than mere discomfort. It represents his first profound experience of institutional unfairness. His classmates, recognizing the injustice, encourage him to speak with the rector. This creates Stephen's first serious moral dilemma between accepting authority and standing up for himself. His journey through the corridors to the rector's office symbolizes his first conscious challenge to authority. The rector's understanding response and promise to address the situation leads to a moment of triumph, though Stephen consciously tempers his pride, revealing both his natural confidence and the influence of his religious education. During summer in Blackrock, Stephen's imagination flourishes as he forms a playgroup with Aubrey Mills. His deliberate choice of simple attire, inspired by Napoleon, shows early signs of his artistic self-development. Their adventures, exploring neighborhood territories and creating imaginative scenarios among the rocks, represent the final pure expressions of childhood creativity. When autumn arrives and the group naturally disbands, Stephen experiences his first clear sense that his path will be different. Observing the routine of daily life, like milk deliveries, he instinctively knows such ordinary patterns aren't his destiny, an early sign of his artistic calling. The family's financial challenges force them to leave Black Rock, and Stephen watches their belongings being transported away from a train window. This physical relocation becomes symbolic of his growing emotional and intellectual distance from his surroundings. In Dublin, he develops keen observational abilities that will later enhance his artistic perspective, mentally documenting the city's geography and its inhabitants with careful attention. At a children's gathering in Harold's Cross, he experiences early romantic awareness through shared glances with a young girl. The subsequent tram journey becomes a study in youthful hesitation. Though drawn to express his feelings, he remains still, establishing a pattern of emotional restraint that will influence both his personal development and artistic journey. As Stephen enters adolescence, his intellectual and sexual awakening accelerates simultaneously. At Belvedere College, he distinguishes himself academically while experiencing the tumult of puberty. His essay on the creator and soul provokes accusations of heresy from Mr. Tate, the English master, an early sign of Stephen's unconventional thinking. When confronted by schoolmates about literature, he boldly declares Byron superior to Tennyson, prompting them to beat him for defending a heretic and immoral poet. This incident crystallizes Stephen's growing alienation from conventional morality. His wanderings through Dublin streets become increasingly purposeful as sexual desire overtakes him. The vivid description of his savage desires, making nothing sacred, reveals the intensity of adolescent lust. His nightly prowling through dark, slimy streets culminates in his first sexual encounter with a prostitute. Joyce's portrayal of this moment is remarkably nuanced. Stephen experiences it as both surrender and triumph, conscious of nothing but the dark pressure of her softly parting lips. After this initiation, Stephen enters a period of deliberate sin. The mathematical equations on his scribbler page spread out a widening tail, eyed and starred like a peacock's, symbolizing his expanding transgressions. Yet instead of feeling maimed by sin, he experiences a dark peace between body and soul, leaving him with cold, indifferent knowledge. This spiritual numbness is punctuated by moments of religious terror as he contemplates the multiplying consequences of his sins. The retreat sermons at Belvedere trigger Stephen's crisis of conscience. The priest's vivid descriptions of hell, its physical torments, eternal duration, and company of demons penetrate Stephen's defenses. The sermon's language is deliberately excessive, with images of huge swarms of repulsive creatures and sinners packed like bees in a hive. This rhetorical bombardment breaks through Stephen's indifference, leaving him filled with cold and horror. When he vomits after dinner, his physical revulsion mirrors his spiritual nausea. Stephen's subsequent confession represents a psychological breakthrough. In the confessional, his sins trickle from his lips in shameful drops from his soul, festering and oozing like a sore. The priest's gentle admonition falls like sweet rain upon his quaking, parching heart. After receiving absolution, Stephen feels his soul made fair and holy once more, experiencing a profound sense of spiritual rebirth. Stephen's religious conversion fundamentally transforms his daily existence into an intensely regimented devotional practice. Each morning begins with a carefully orchestrated ritual of hallowing himself before holy images, meticulously arranging sacred objects, and organizing his day into distinct periods of prayer and contemplation. He carries rosary beads everywhere, constantly running them through his fingers while walking, using each bead as a prompt for meditation. His soul embraces the burden of pieties, masses, prayers, sacraments, and mortifications with meek acceptance, turning every moment into an opportunity for spiritual reflection. The discipline he imposes on his senses is particularly severe and all-encompassing. He trains himself to walk with perpetually downcast eyes, avoiding any glimpse that might provoke impure thoughts. His voice, breaking with adolescence, becomes something he refuses to control, accepting its changes as divine will. He deliberately subjects himself to unpleasant odors as a form of mortification, and at meals he follows strict habits of minimal consumption, treating each bite as an exercise in self-denial. Even his sleeping position becomes a matter of religious significance as he arranges himself to mirror Christ's suffering. Yet beneath this facade of perfect devotion, Stephen remains deeply troubled by what he perceives as spiritual imperfections. The smallest disruptions, his mother's sneeze during prayer, a door slamming during meditation, or a stray thought during Mass, provoke disproportionate guilt and anxiety. His confessions become increasingly frequent but mechanical, focused on cataloging minor transgressions rather than achieving genuine spiritual growth. The Eucharist, once a source of transcendent joy, now feels routine and empty, no longer providing those dissolving moments of self-surrender he previously experienced in private spiritual communion. This growing spiritual aridity becomes a harbinger of his eventual break with the Church. When the director suggests Stephen might have a vocation for priesthood, describing it as the greatest honor that the Almighty God can bestow upon a man, the possibility ignites both attraction and repulsion. Stephen's cheeks flame with recognition, as he has often imagined himself performing priestly duties, though significantly, he's always preferred imagining himself in minor sacred offices rather than as the main celebrant. This preference reveals his unconscious resistance to full religious commitment. As he seriously contemplates novitiate life, memories of his time at Clongowes flood back, the cold corridors, the tepid baths, the rigid schedules, awakening a subtle, hostile instinct against religious life. He begins to recoil from what he now sees as the chill, ordered existence that would inevitably strip away his individuality and artistic aspirations. The mental image of himself as the Reverend Stephen Dedalus, S.J., transforms into a sour-faced specter with suffocated anger, a vision that crystallizes his growing resistance to religious life. Walking past the Jesuit house one day, Stephen experiences a moment of profound clarity. His soul has already rejected this path. He realizes he is destined to learn his own wisdom apart from others, marking his first significant rejection of an established societal path. This decisive moment prefigures his later rejections of family obligations and national identity, establishing a pattern of choosing personal authenticity over institutional belonging. Stephen's epiphany on Dollymount Strand represents his true awakening to artistic vocation. After refusing the priesthood, he experiences an ecstasy of flight as his soul soars beyond the world. This is the true call of life, not the pale service of the altar. His soul has risen from the grave of boyhood, and he resolves to create a living thing, new and soaring and beautiful. The girl standing in the water becomes the catalyst for this transformation. Her image passes into his soul in holy silence, and he runs wildly along the shore, embracing life's call. This moment directly contrasts with his earlier religious devotion. Here, the natural world and female beauty inspire genuine spiritual ecstasy, unlike the forced pieties of his religious phase. At university, Stephen develops his aesthetic theory through conversations with Lynch. He defines pity as the feeling which arrests the mind in the presence of whatsoever is grave and constant in human sufferings and unites it with the human sufferer, and terror as that which unites it with the secret cause. True art, he argues, produces static emotion that arrests the mind, while improper art produces kinetic emotions like desire or loathing. Drawing from Aquinas, Stephen identifies three qualities necessary for beauty: integritas, wholeness, consonancia, harmony, and claritas, radiance. He elaborates that art divides into three forms, lyrical, epical, and dramatic, progressing from the artist's direct relationship to self, then to others, and finally creating characters with independent aesthetic life. The artist, Stephen concludes, ultimately remains within or behind or beyond or above his handiwork, invisible, refined out of existence, indifferent, paring his fingernails. Stephen's moment of pure poetic inspiration near dawn represents the fulfillment of his artistic calling. A spirit filled him, pure as the purest water, sweet as dew, moving as music. This seraphic ecstasy transforms into poetic creation as he composes a villanelle, capturing both his desire and spiritual exhaustion in refrains of "Are you not weary of ardent ways?" and "Tell no more of enchanted days." As Stephen matures, his rejection of conventional ties becomes more explicit and increasingly painful. His mother's hostility to his university ambitions signals a first noiseless sundering of their lives, marking the beginning of a deep familial rift that would never fully heal. The intimate yet uncomfortable moment when she scrubs his neck and ears, lamenting that a university student needs maternal washing, becomes a powerful symbol of the tension between maternal love and intellectual independence. Stephen experiences these moments as suffocating attempts to infantilize him, even as he recognizes the genuine care behind them. Walking through rain-soaked Dublin streets, he consciously shakes off family voices that threaten to humble the pride of his youth, voices that echo with generations of expectations and traditional values. Stephen's rejection of Irish nationalism crystallizes in his pivotal conversation with Davin, the earnest nationalist who urges him to be one of us. The exchange reveals the fundamental conflict between collective identity and individual artistic vision. Stephen responds with increasing passion and eloquence. "This race and this country and this life produced me. I shall express myself as I am." His rejection of Davin's nationalist appeals is rooted in both intellectual conviction and emotional pain, as he bitterly recounts how Ireland has betrayed its heroes from Wolfe Tone to Charles Stuart Parnell. Each example he cites, Tone's death, Parnell's fall, the countless failed rebellions, becomes evidence of Ireland's self-defeating pattern of raising up leaders only to destroy them. His famous declaration about nets flung at the soul, "You talk to me of nationality, language, religion, I shall try to fly by those nets," establishes his commitment to artistic freedom as something transcending national loyalty. The final and perhaps most wrenching break comes with religion, played out in his intense conversation with Cranley, his closest friend. When asked if he has ever loved anyone, Stephen's admission that he tried to love God but failed reveals the depth of his spiritual struggle. The exchange becomes more pointed when Cranley urges him to take communion simply to please his mother, arguing with simple eloquence, "Whatever else is unsure in this stinking dunghill of a world, a mother's love is not." Their theological debate, touching on faith, doubt, and the nature of belief, culminates in Stephen's manifesto, a declaration that becomes the philosophical foundation for his artistic exile. "I will not serve that in which I no longer believe, whether it call itself my home, my fatherland, or my church, and I will try to express myself in some mode of life or art as freely as I can and as wholly as I can, using for my defense the only arms I allow myself to use, silence, exile, and cunning." This triple rejection of family, nation, and religion becomes the necessary precondition for his emergence as an artist, though the cost of this freedom weighs heavily on him. The novel's final section, written as intimate journal entries, meticulously chronicles Stephen's evolving artistic consciousness as he prepares for his self-imposed exile from Ireland. His observations become increasingly lyrical and imagistic as spring unfolds, reflecting his developing poetic sensibility. Wild Spring, Scudding Clouds, Oh Life. These entries reveal both his growing artistic maturity and his increasing emotional distance from his homeland. He contemplates women's complex relationship to past and future, seeing in them both the weight of tradition and the promise of renewal, while recording brief social encounters with a new philosophical detachment that marks his transition from participant to observer. Standing on the library steps of his university, Stephen watches birds wheeling in the March evening sky, a moment of profound symbolism that crystallizes his artistic awakening. The swallows, returned from the south, become a powerful metaphor for his own impending journey, as they build ever an unlasting home under the eaves of men's houses. This image resonates with his own sense of temporary belonging and inevitable departure. Poetry flows through him like the noise of many waters, suggesting both biblical imagery and natural force, while he experiences the soft peace of silent spaces, a moment of clarity that confirms his artistic calling. His final journal entries pulse with determination and defiance. His famous declaration to encounter for the millionth time the reality of experience and to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race becomes both a personal manifesto and an artistic mission statement. This powerful metaphor of the forge connects his creative process to both ancient craft and spiritual transformation. The novel concludes with his invocation, "Old Father, old Artificer, stand me now and ever in good stead," a complex prayer that links Stephen to his mythical namesake, Daedalus, the master craftsman who crafted wings for himself and his son Icarus to escape imprisonment in Crete. This conclusion masterfully completes Stephen's transformation from innocent child to independent artist, tracing his evolution through successive stages of awareness and rebellion. Through his systematic rejection of the traditional pillars of Irish identity, family, Catholic religion, and nationalist politics, the nets he sees flung to hold back his flight, he achieves the intellectual and spiritual freedom he deems necessary for authentic artistic creation. His physical and spiritual journey represents not just personal growth, but embodies the universal struggle to define oneself against the weight of societal expectations and cultural inheritance. In Stephen's flight, Joyce captures the essential conflict between individual artistic vision and collective identity that defines the modern condition, while also exploring the price of artistic freedom and the complex relationship between creation and exile. Joyce's revolutionary narrative technique, allowing language to evolve with his protagonist's consciousness, transformed modern literature. The novel's opening, with its childlike, "once upon a time and a very good time it was," gradually gives way to the sophisticated philosophical language of the university chapters, mirroring Stephen's intellectual development. This linguistic evolution is particularly evident in scenes like the Christmas dinner argument, where young Stephen's limited comprehension of adult politics is reflected in fragmented, observation-focused prose, contrasting sharply with the complex aesthetic theories he articulates in his later university years. Beyond its stylistic innovations, the novel's exploration of artistic awakening continues to resonate with readers seeking their authentic voice. Stephen's declaration that he will forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race speaks to the artist's responsibility to articulate what remains unspoken in society. This metaphor of artistic creation as forgery connects to the novel's larger themes of creation and rebellion, suggesting that authentic art requires both craftsmanship and courage to challenge existing norms. The novel's unflinching examination of sexuality, religious doubt, and national identity challenged conventions of its time and continues to provoke reflection today. Joyce's detailed portrayal of Stephen's sexual awakening, from his confused adolescent encounters to his philosophical reconciliation of physical and spiritual desire, broke new ground in literary frankness. His treatment of religious doubt, particularly through Stephen's rejection of the priesthood and subsequent spiritual crisis, created a template for modern coming-of-age narratives. Through Stephen Dedalus, whose very name combines the martyred Saint Stephen with the ingenious artificer Daedalus, Joyce created a character whose struggle to transcend limitations speaks to anyone who has felt constrained by circumstance or tradition. The novel's influence extends beyond its thematic concerns to its structural innovations. Joyce's use of free indirect discourse, stream of consciousness, and epiphanic moments became foundational techniques for modernist literature. His integration of Catholic imagery, Irish mythology, and classical references created a complex cultural tapestry that demonstrated how personal identity is shaped by competing historical and social forces. In the end, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man is not merely about becoming an artist, but about becoming oneself. A universal journey of self-discovery that makes this novel as relevant today as when it first appeared over a century ago. As we follow Stephen's path from conformity to freedom, we recognize our own struggles to break free from the nets that would hold us back from flight. The novel's enduring power lies in its ability to capture both the particular experience of early 20th century Irish Catholic life and the universal experience of seeking personal authenticity in the face of social pressure.